Hello and welcome to this audio presentation of Australian Anthill Magazine's first ever event, The Buck Starts Here, held in Melbourne on the 23rd of February 2006 in the Ernst & Young building. I'm Australian Anthill editor Paul Ryan. To fill you in on some background, in late September 2005, I caught up with five of Australia's leading early stage venture capitalists at the Australian Venture Capital Association's annual conference on the Gold Coast. These interviews form the basis of our December-January cover story, The Buck Starts Here, which generated so much interest that we decided to host a follow-on event. This is the fly-on-the-wall recording of that event. We'd like to thank the event's sponsors, Ernst & Young and Oz Industry. I hope you find it both informative and enjoyable.
Grab one of these pieces of paper, Janine just over there, and she'll get you just scribble all over it, and we'll have a look at it a little bit later. And then from those particular bits of paper, we'll decide who the three companies that we'll get to ask talk about their own company and ask for some feedback from our esteemed guests.
It'll work now.
Don't be shy. We'll be nice to you.
Yeah, they'll try and be gentle.
Very encouraging will be.
And on that point, you'll probably notice at the bottom of the form that there's a legal disclaimer, which I must mention because it says, don't take anything that they say as legal or business advice, just in case you follow it and you get it all wrong.
But of course, if you do get it right.
Well, if you do get it right, we'll be giving you a phone call.
Check.
Well, good evening. My name's James Tuckerman. I'm the founder and editor-in-chief of Australian Anthill. Started a little business magazine 2.5 years ago. And I'm exceptionally pleased to be here tonight because I can look around at all these people and think, wow, these people have picked up this little idea that we had 2.5 years ago. They've read it and they've liked it and they've turned up. More than that, I'd like to congratulate you on taking the initiative for registering so early. What you may not realise is that of the 120 seats that we have allocated, I think we had 240 people register in about 2 days. Closed registrations, and now we've had up to 600 expressions of interest wanting to come to our event. So well done for getting in so early. Next time you'll be first on the list, so you can come along to the next events that we hold as well too. So congratulations also to our panelists for being so popular. Hey. In a couple of minutes, I'll introduce these stars of the early VC space. But first, of course, I'd like to acknowledge and thank some people because, as you can see, this is an astonishing venue and an astonishing turnout, and everything looks fantastic. And apart from some beats, the audio is great too. But I must thank some of those people and groups. One of those groups is the Entrepreneurs Organisation, and I see a couple of people from that organisation here tonight. If anyone doesn't know about that group, it's something that any entrepreneur should aspire to belong to. It's a very select group in the sense that you must meet certain criteria to join, such as your business must have a certain revenue and so many staff and all the rest. But the great thing about that is that you find yourself surrounded by a network of peers that are pretty business savvy and pretty smart. And they also hold a range of different mentoring programs as well too. So if you see anyone from EO around here tonight, go over and say hello, ask about EO. But also, they're interesting people in their own right, worth chatting to, so get to know them. Another group I'd like to acknowledge is Oz Industry. Our mates at Oz Industry. For their foresight in joining Anthill in the very early levels of the business when we were, we had a mini controlled circulation next to nothing, and they saw the potential and they came and joined us. A number of Oz Industry people here tonight, mini programs they offer to fast track, fast growth businesses and technologies. So if you spot anyone from Oz Industry, say hello as well too. And last but definitely not least, I must thank our wonderful host sponsors here, Ernst & Young, with the best view in Melbourne. And also some of the great, nicest canapes as well too. But I'd like to tell a little bit of a story about Ernst & Young, which demonstrates that they're such a proactive and open-minded group of people, which they honestly are. One of my first encounters with Ernst & Young was with a chap called Bill Dells, who unfortunately couldn't be here tonight. He's from Sydney, but he looks after that wonderful program that David talked about before, Ernst & Young Entrepreneur of the Year. And the first thing that Bill said to me when I met him, he said, "I know Ant Hill. That's the business magazine that's like BRW meets FHM." That's a phrase I've loved and I've used again and again to this day. Not because we feature any scantily clad women in our magazine, but because we're cheeky. We're very proud to be cheeky, and it's something that I hope will continue to be. The other thing as well too, but why I'd particularly like to thank them, is that as some of you know, we actually had a venue hitch, so some people may have turned up at Melbourne Town Hall and been redirected to here. We actually, there was a venue hitch, we found ourselves an out of venue on about the 9th of February. I called up the marketing people in Sydney at Ernst & Young and said, "Help me out." They said, "Call our mate Bills. He's on holiday, but he won't mind if you call him on his mobile." I called him up and he was on the beach. Lucky voter, and he said, "I'll tell you what, I'll let you know in 48 hours where we can help you out." Within 24, David Peterson had given me a call. Within 48 hours, we had a venue. So many thanks to Ernst & Young for helping us out on this night. Now, I'd like to introduce our stars. But rather than go one by one and talk about each one of these people, what would be much nicer if that they introduced themselves? So what I'll do is, maybe I'll hit them with a loaded question, and we'll allow them to introduce themselves in that capacity. I don't have a podium, so I'm going to move some papers around if you don't mind.
All good, hopefully effective.
Perhaps we'll start down here. Brigitte. Please help me out. Is that really how you say your name?
Yes, it is.
It is how you say your name. Well done. You have a strange accent and a difficult to pronounce name.
There's nothing strange about my accent.
Are you from Australia?
Yes.
You're from Australia? And how did you find yourself working for GBS, career-wise and life-wise?
Okay, so I went to the United States to go to business school, worked in a VC-backed startup, which was NASDAQ-listed, in an environmental technology area in the United States for a couple of years, came back to Australia, nothing equivalent that I could work in here, went to work at Melbourne Uni, trying to work at how Melbourne Uni could commercialise some of the technologies it had, and did some consulting work for Jeff Brook, who was then working at Rothschild, which was a life science venture capital firm, and went to work there, and Jeff and I bought the business from Rothschild in 2003, so that GBS Venture Partners is Jeff Brook, Brigitte Smith Venture Partners, and we are a life science specialist investor, so that's kind of how I got to be here. And I have a little hint of American accent because I've spent lots of time working in the States, but I'm Australian.
Okay, and GBS, what is that specialise in?
So we just do life sciences. So life sciences means medical devices, new drugs, and anything medical. So it could be medical services, could be environmental technology, could be agricultural technology. But really, it's 90% medical devices and drugs.
Thank you. I jump over this end now. Stuart from Chan. You belong to Chan.
Yep. Everything,
everything belongs to Chan. You work for Chan. Sounds like they own you. Chan is one of the longest histories in the VC space in Australia, yes?
Yep.
Where did it begin, and how has, where do you fit in, and what's the fund that you look after, and how does that fit into the broader scheme of things?
Okay. It started about 18 years ago with Australian Mezzanine Investments, started by Bill Ferris and Joe Skrzynski, who are still the chairman and managing director of what is now Chan. Around about 2000, we split the business into two. We formed Champ and Champ Ventures, so I worked for the Champ Ventures part of the group. And Champ Ventures has a relatively broad investment mandate. So we run two funds. We run Antwin, which is an early stage technology venture capital fund. We don't specialise in any technology, so we've done IT deals, biotech deals, and also mining-related engineering deals. So we've got a broad focus there. And then we also run Champ Ventures number 5 fund, which is more of an expansion capital and a sort of mid-market MBA fund. So they're the funds that we're actively investing in.
I understand that you have a strong focus on seed and pre-seed. Is that correct?
No. So good opportunity to clarify that. Anwin's startup and early expansion, but it had one in particular really big success early on. It looked smart and made 100 times its money, which was a fairly large multiple on the whole fund. And so we've been able to take more of an even riskier approach. So we have strayed into one of our biotech deals. We've had two people, they each had a white coat and a fantastic idea, and that was about it when we backed them. We've now put about $6 million into that business, and 4 years later, it's now early stage, so it's still pretty risky. But it's a fascinating company that we've got big hopes for. But as a rule, we're a little bit further down the road.
Mental check. We've got Michael here with an easy first name, but more difficult last name, from Starfish Ventures. Tell me, Starfish, that's a fairly unusual name for a fund.
Yeah, well, look, all of you, when you go out and start up a business, you sort of say to yourself, what are we going to call ourselves? And ultimately, we wanted something that explained to people what we did. And we played with lots of names, and the great names like TBP had already been taken. So, we were still at the bottom of the queue. So our PA basically came up with Starfish, and the concept is, we're there from the start to the finish, and it really sort of typifies that we see ourselves as business builders. So hence the name Starfish.
You got all these wonderful diagrams that say we have five steps to...
We started trying to do that, and then we gave up after about a week. Doing five of everything.
Stick to start to finish. So what sort of companies do you look at?
Okay, so we are a very broadly focused fund. So we invest all the way from sort of biotech investments or life science all the way to IT and something in between. So if you look at our portfolio, we try to use the 40-40-20 rule. 40% of the portfolio ends up broadly in IT, 40% in life sciences, and 20% what we call other. And that allows us to do any other sort of technology play that doesn't fit nicely within those other two buckets.
Thank you. Jump around here again. John, David, what do you reckon? David.
Ask that pre-seed question again.
Alan and Brackage, you belong to Alan and Brackage. Well, you don't belong to Alan and Brackage. Although it might be like a family. Yeah. Which makes me think, if it is a family, do you have two dads called Roger?
famous two Rogers, yes.
Famous two Rogers.
Every party you go to, oh, I know Roger.
Tell me a little about how the sorts of deals that you look at and what qualifies as a pre-seed investment.
Well, Alan Markridge was traditionally an IT investor. We broadened to include some sciences. Our focus of late has been predominantly into the pre-seed sector. So pre-seed is usually research results, no prototype, no managing team, virtually a clean sheet of paper. Platform technologies, looking for the first application area.
I have a great question for you.
Potentially on public sector research.
Public sector research. Okay. And Johnny, lucky last. Technology venture partners. Now you would assume by that name that it's heavily involved in technology ventures. Would you consider yourself more a money man or a techie man? A tech master? Or money master? How would you describe yourself?
Battle scarred veteran.
Short and sweet. And what sort of companies does TBP look at?
Well, we specialize in information technology and comms related ventures. The whole convergence of computing and communications technologies. We're straight into new media, so pretty broad within that sector. Yeah, it's a very, as you can imagine, a huge sector.
And back to the earlier question, How did you find yourself in this company? Were you working in technology companies or?
Well, I've been in venture capital now for 15 years. As you can probably gather from my accent, I'm not originally from Australia. Came down here in 93 to Winchester, sorry, to actually invest in technology. And so I've been working in the sector in Asia, actually, based in Hong Kong. And I came down to Australia for all the obvious reasons, but also because there's some very interesting opportunities down here. And it was pretty early on then. There weren't many people other than the two Rogers doing that sort of stuff.
Two Rogers and Bill.
Bill was doing a bit of that stuff, yeah. He was doing more.
A bit later stage, yeah.
So at the moment, and I'll just ask you one at a time, what's an interesting company that you're working on at the moment, Brigitte?
We're already invested in? So Pharmax is just an interesting company that we're invested in at the moment. So if you have cystic fibrosis or asthma or chronic bronchitis because you've been a smoker or you've had a respiratory disease at some point in your life, we're developing a medicine for you. $400 million market cap, so it's an ASX and NASDAQ listed company. And it's based on the research from a woman by Dr. Sandra Anderson at Royal Prince Alfred Hospital. And when we found it, they'd been putting powder into capsules by hand and giving it to people in the hospital.
Sounds hygienic. I hope that someone in the audience here tonight is from a life sciences background and has that form and quickly fills it out so that they can talk to Brigitte on her level when it comes to pitching to one IBM. David?
Yeah, many. Probably Vast Audio, an acoustics platform with an application for hearing aids and eliminates the cocktail party effect that hearing aid wearers experience when they wear the current technology available in hearing aids.
I've got a company we've just invested in, actually, and what they do is they read your brain waves. why they do that is they're developing a new computer interface technology targeting the games industry. So it's pretty cool stuff.
Nice. So it's like playing computer games or something plugged into your brain.
Correct.
Wow. That's science fiction. Michael.
Well, it's always hard, and I always hate picking on companies because, you know, as soon as you mention their name, they're not going to perform from then on.
So one of the interesting ones
that I kind of like in our portfolio is based on 802.11, which is sort of the wireless hi-fi network, and what they're trying to do is basically build a new chip that works on that, so you can basically use that same system to develop tags. Now, the way the tag market works is everyone's trying to make super cheap tags, but the infrastructure, the readers are incredibly expensive. The company's saying, well, there's lots of infrastructure out there, maybe we'll make really cheap tags, expensive tags with cheap infrastructure, which is a great spin.
That's certainly a change.
Well, after Michael's theory of success, maybe I should talk about somebody else's portfolio company. I will stick with one of my own, a company called Ingenic. It's the two guys in white coats. The technology they've got is creating sort of mini cells out of bacteria and then loading those mini cells with primarily anti-cancer drugs, fixing a targeting system to the cell, which sort of takes that cell directly to cancer tumours. It's taken up by the tumour and then the cell is naturally broken down, releasing the drugs actually inside the tumour. So the fascinating thing is that they can deliver somewhere between 1/2000th and 1/5000th of the drugs that you would normally need to deliver and have a much better impact. The challenge at the moment is we can only cure mice of cancer and that's not a really big market. So we need to get it into humans.
Very happy mice. Very happy with your work. Sydney, before you were talking about how you'd invested in LookSmart, it was returned 100 times the value, and you were able to invest in some more risky ventures. Now, people in the venture capital space have a reputation for being risk averse. Is that true? Would you agree or not agree?
Not if you look at Edwin's portfolio, no. And I'm sure that would apply to a number of my colleagues as well. you have to take risk to make money, and we invested in 11 companies. It went through the sort of IT boom and the IT bust. I joined it after Looksmart, unfortunately, but literally in between my resignation from Ernst & Young and joining Amwin 3 months later, three of their portfolio companies went bust. So they were certainly taking risks. We let a fourth one go soon after I joined. We just didn't feel that it was worth putting more funds into, and we've fought pretty hard for the other ones. And fortunately, I think that most of those will end up doing quite well. Some of them better than quite well. So
does anyone disagree? Does anyone think that that people working in venture capital are risk averse?
Yeah, I do. Where does our money come from? It comes from superannuation funds. You all have superannuation. Probably most of you have the superannuation managed by somebody else. And our job is not to take stupid risks. Our job is to take risks that we can manage. So we each have a particular area that we focus on, and our job is to stick to the area where we can manage the risk that is inherent in the company by the skills that we have to bring to bear, plus diversification. But it's not our job to take superannuation funds money and throw it out the window. That's not our job. Our job is to judiciously make investments that have manageable risks. We're not supposed to be stupid risk takers. We're supposed to be manageable, sensible, quantifiable risk takers. That's our job.
So what's a reasonable expectation in terms of deal ratio success to failure? Someone who hasn't answered before, John.
Well, I mean, there's rules of thumb, clearly. You know, when you're constructing a portfolio, most firms would, I think, target at least 10 portfolio companies. And, you know, we're all striving to get those one or two out of those 10 companies that will be a very big success. You know, ideally a Looksmart type success. That's the model that's been tried and tested in the US. And then, you know, beyond that, one or two that are really successful, you get, I don't know, three, four that do okay, you know, maybe get 2 to 3 times your money back on in that range. And then you get some that you just get your money back on, and then you're inevitably in a portfolio of 10 companies getting 3-4 companies that are not going to make it.
So when do you know when to quit?
There's no sort of right answer to any of this. This is kind of the experience factor, which is a big part of this business. And you know, at the end of the day, we're paid as specialist managers who do this day in, day out for a living to make those calls. And it's tough. It's really tough.
I'll tell you one of the million-dollar questions that people keep asking us at Antil. And there's probably a couple of people who have been in this situation and thought it before. And David triggered the question in my head a little bit earlier when he was talking about dealing with companies that really have nothing on, really the very beginning stages, the expression that you use. The question is, in that sort of environment, how do you value a company for the purpose of investing in it when it may not have any financial runs on the board?
That's a great question. There really is no empirical way to do it. You can't do it by... Can't do it by proxy, can't do it by discounted cash flows, and all the traditional tools and techniques that most people come at it with, and so they learn at business school. To be quite frank with you, we have tried to, because we work so early, we have tried to evolve a formula for pricing and get that formula accepted so that we don't have to have a battle each and every time we go down a negotiation. And the basic idea is that my money is worth your IP. The question is, how much of my money is worth your IP? And you try to get it symmetrical. I can tell you that there's never enough equity to go around for anybody at the pre-seed and seed stage. Right? So it's very tough. But it's, you really back into just how much equity do I need to have after 3-4 rounds when this thing's going to exit. And you have to forecast forward. If I have a major minor stake for putting $500,000 into this deal or $1 billion into this deal, okay, what's that going to look like? What's that stakeholding going to look like after the next 3 rounds? it's going to get to the assuming just gets halved each time. And you want to be, you want to have at least 20% of a deal at the end of the day. And that leads you to another point, is to say, what do we think this thing's going to exit for? So if we always say, look, this is a great opportunity to make a great small business, but we really need to find things that are going to generate $50 to $100 million enterprise value on exit, because if we own, 15% or 10% of that, that's $10 or $15 million on a, $1, $2, $3 million investment. And you need to have a 5 to 10x on your investments.
So two big questions for everyone here. What would you say is a fairly average or reasonable equity stake that an investor will take for an early round? I know there'll be lots and lots of answers for that. And how much of an equity stake do you want to end up with? I know that's a big question because it's so well
known. It's not that big of a question in the sense that there's, traditionally, if you're talking about early stage venture investing and using sort of the U.S. model, it's very well established in the U.S. If you go to market, they're saying, they're looking at you, are you a Series A deal? Are you a Series B deal? Are you a Series C deal? What that means is they know how to price you depending upon what kind of deal you are. And they know that if you're a Series A deal, I'm going to put $3 to $5 million into you, and I need to have about a third. All right, so there's a little bit of a small range, but it's a tight range. So they need to have a third. And that's pretty much an algorithm that everybody uses. And that algorithm also applies here in Australia, but it breaks down a little bit. When you go before what we call Series A, that's a company that would have revenue, but it wouldn't be profitable or cash flow positive. I would have the semblance of a management team, but maybe not completely fleshed out. But when you go before Series A and you talk about C, then it gets really ambiguous, high price.
I haven't asked Michael a question in a while. There's going to be a number of business owners in this room, and if they're seeking private equity, they're going to go sit down with the person that they're negotiating with, and you are going to say, our expectation is that we would need this percentage of the company for this amount of capital. How do you manage an entrepreneur's expectations, business owner's expectations?
Well, from our perspective, we just need to be upfront about what it takes to do a deal. And it's a competitive market, so if the entrepreneur is unhappy with the deal that we've got on offer, they could go elsewhere. What drives us in terms of what stake we need is the metrics that David spoke about, but it's also knowledge about what the next round's going to be like. So for example, one of the things, if you go and do a Series B in the US, whatever you raise will be equivalent to the value of the company, so you have to give up approximately 50% of the company. So you have to be aware of the metrics that are going to apply, and you have to basically explain that to the entrepreneur and say, look, this is the way it's going to work going forward, and this is why I need this type of stake.
If I could just add to that, so that's from the investor's perspective. The balancing item is, if the founder and the management team who's going to take the opportunity forward don't own enough for it to be worth their while going to work, making the opportunity happen, the business isn't going to function, and the investors aren't going to get a return for their capital. So it's got to work, the numbers have to work for the investors, the numbers also have to work for the founders. And so as a general rule of thumb, I think that we all like to see employee share ownership programs in place so that the people that are hired to run the company and make it work own 15 to 20% of the company, maybe 10% in other industries, but that's kind of the range that you want the employees to own. And then the founders have to own something, particularly if the founders are going to be involved in the success of making the company develop into a successful investment for us. So there's all of the financial metrics for the investors, and then there's what the founders and the employees need to own so that they're motivated to make it a successful investment. And those factors are in balance. And I think particularly in early stage, which we also do at GBS, we do a range from early to later stage investing, we really look at, is there enough in this for the founder? And so we're not trying to just drive a punitive deal. We're trying to make a deal that has everybody motivated to make the investment successful and to make the company succeed.
I think that's a really good point. There's just the old saying that you need a bank up until the day they lend you the money, and then they need you. It works for venture capital as well. It's very important to us that the entrepreneur and the well, the senior team, feel that they're adequately compensated. Because if they don't, and I've experienced this as an entrepreneur myself, they're going to spend the next 2 and 3 years trying to claw back what they think you took away from them. That company's going to go sideways every time. So we actually tend to be very generous and then expect a lot. Where you run into problems in pricing and trying to get enough equity in everybody's pockets is when there's somebody in the deal that isn't productive, somebody in the deal that's got a founder stake, but they're not relevant to the forward proposition. And then they're the ones that really create a lot of complexity around the initial pricing. But our, and you could go, and I always encourage people to go and talk to our CEOs and our senior team members of our companies and talk to them about this topic, because you know, we deal with them generously, and it served us well. And I think it's a myth that, you know, when people have the view that venture capitalists screw the entrepreneurs, I'm sure it certainly has happened, but I think that those would be people who would be very short-sighted.
You must have an incentivized CEO. I'm just going to stop for a second. Does anyone have any of those forms that they've filled out and they'd like to pass them to Janine? Because she's going to take them outside and have a look at them. And no one? Anyone? Oh, come on! You chicken?
Can I get a form?
You have a form? We'll grab you. I'll give you my form. Return to my train of thought, and I was looking at Stuart over here, and I had a question, and now I've got to remember what it is.
Yeah, I might just raise another comment while you think of that question, and that is, in terms of the negotiation, the more experienced the management team, the shorter the negotiation. And the reason being is that a management team who's done it before knows what a good deal is, and would come to the VC and say, here's the deal, and generally that's a deal that the VC can accept. When you've got inexperienced management teams, they've got naive views about what the technology is worth, what type of deal they could drive, and that's when you get the huge amount of friction. So generally speaking, the more experienced the team, they know what the market dynamics are of that deal.
And just on that, I mean, the reality is in Australia, one of the problems is that there are not many experienced entrepreneurs to be there before. We all know that, but there are places that you can find out about some of this stuff.
Events.
You know, we're all involved in a program called VC Connect, where we go into, you know, the ins and outs, term sheets, all that sort of stuff. But just basic things like, you know, we refer to valuation as one of the topics that frequently was discussed. The metrics that David's talked about are out there on the web. You know, you can go and find out what the median pricing of a Series A round is. So, you know, if the median price of a Series A, which is about $5 or $6 million US, in the US, and that's typically for a team that's very well credentialed, you know, it's hard when somebody comes into a VC here in Australia and says, well, we think our business is worth, you know, $20 million today, and, you know, by the way, I've never done this before. So,
yeah, a good VC would just try to figure out, where are you sliding? Are you a seed company? Are you a Series A company? And there are criteria which establish you as one or the other. And once I know whether you're an A or a B or a seed company, I know how to price you. I know what terms to ask for. It's a very transparent industry. There's a repository of information, for example, through Fenwick & West. They're a law firm in the U.S. and they publish quarterly deal term survey in the Valley, so you know how many people got weighted average ratchets, who got full ratchets, how many deals had liquidation preferences, what were the multiples on, you know, what were the step-ups round to round. It's a very transparent industry, but there's perhaps, you know, we need more of these types of forums in order to kind of get that information out there.
I'm going to move on from topics of evaluation. See some people shifting in their seat. If you've written the name of that web address, you can check it out later. But I have a scenario for you. When we were talking about keeping the CEO on side and obviously managing the deal so that they're happy with it. There is a fear among many entrepreneurial CEOs, business owners, that once they raise the money, the VC is going to move them on and hire a more experienced CEO. Is that something that you see is likely to happen? Not like that. Has it happened? Is it a relevant fear?
Highly unlikely that you're going to, unless you've said, listen, I want to invest in your business, but you're not the person to run this company. you're not going to do, it's not a stealth plan. There's never going to be a stealth plan. You're at least going to have a couple of years running the company. If you screw it up, then you can, and you don't perform, then you can expect that the investors are going to have some thoughts about what to do about that. And it won't probably be keeping you there to screw it up for another 2 years. But if they're planning to roll you, they're going to tell you straight away. There's just absolutely nothing in it for the investor to go through the heartache of investing and 5 minutes after the investment has occurred saying, you're out of here. You know, that's just not something that is in any way in our interest or attractive to do.
I think the other thing to point out is never just the VC deciding to get rid of the CEO, it's the board. And you know, we always seek to have two independents on every board, and we insist on that in that deal. That, you know, does not necessarily work in our favor if they don't agree with us per se, and that has happened. But we seek to have two good, you know, high quality independents that all the parties to the deal agree to on the board. And it's the board that hires the CEO, not the investor. We'll have to remember that. But having said that, you know, there's an often bandied metric that says, you know, the average early stage VC CEO lasts for 18 months. I don't know if that's true. That hasn't been our experience. We have had these problems. It's always a difficult and challenge, but it is. It's never just, you know, A and B trying to convince CEO. It's a board decision. And we're not the only parties on the board.
But you have never invested in the next day said, sorry, you're fired, have you? Not having signaled that as an issue beforehand.
No, not at all. In fact, we do use, because I operate very, very early in the market, we do use interim CEOs, and you know they specialize in getting the company through its first 12 to 18 months of life, and then cycling off that and going on. We have some CEOs that run two companies.
Clearly, companies outgrow founders at times, and that's true of very mature businesses as well. And so it wouldn't be uncommon within our portfolio that the founders are still with the business. They might now be the technology director rather than the CEO, but they were probably the CEO for the first couple of years, and some of them are still the CEO. So it really is a case-by-case basis. We try and address that up front, but we certainly wouldn't invest in that. Any technology company, like any business, is all about people actually rather than technology. People are the key thing. So it's very important to us that we're backing the right people at the outset. But we're also up front and say, look, here's how it's going to work if things are going wrong. And it's covered in a shareholders agreement as to, you know, what rights the board has to move a CEO upon, and then how their shares are treated in that scenario as well.
So has it happened?
Yeah, certainly has.
The opposite thing happens, which is that you have people signing up to be not compete with the business and to be retained by the business, actually. So there are all sorts of terms in standard venture capital term sheets that say, you know, we want the employers and the key people and the founders' shares to vest over time because we want you to be committed to staying in the venture. So. And that's often quite a useful discussion to have with people. If they say, I don't want my shares to vest, that's a signal to us that they're planning to leave just after the financing has happened when they've got the price secured. So I think the reverse is almost the case at some times. However, if somebody is the CEO of the company and they're not performing, we're not charity managers, we're investors.
I'm gonna bring things back to basics. I keep hearing about these statistics about the likelihood of actually securing venture capital private equity. I have heard that it is only 0.1% of people who actively go seeking it successfully get it. Now, I'll ask Stuart whether he thinks that that's the case, but I'll ask him in particular because I'm wondering whether 10 years ago, whether the experience at in your company would have been the same, or whether things have changed.
I can only talk about the experience 6 years ago.
Okay.
So you'll have to put up with that for a minute. The ratio has certainly changed. I'd say it's now there's a higher success rate, although I think I'd have to qualify that by pointing out that we do invest across the range, and so our statistics in particular will include relatively late stage deals and management buyers as well. But certainly when I first got involved in Amwin, we would be looking at something like 500 or 600 deals a year, and we would probably be investing in sort of 2 to 4 of those. I actually know what the numbers were for 2005 because we had an investors meeting yesterday and we had to give them the statistics. So last year we looked at 275 deals. We made 16 offers and we ended up investing in 7 companies.
That's not bad. That's 5%.
It's better than 1 in 1,000.
Better than 1 in 1,000.
Yeah, so sorry, but like we work on 1 in 100, and that's sort of a global metric. So if you talk to VCs in the US, they would quote that same number, which makes me think sometimes, you know, we're too easy to get money off. Because if it's 1 in 100 in the US, and the market in Australia is not as well developed, it should be greater than 1 in 100, might be 1 in 200 if I was using the same metrics as a US VC or the same standard. And certainly in the pre-seed arena, again, you would argue, well, it's 1 in 100 for a formal venture deal, it's got to be higher odds. And in fact, it's the exact opposite. Because there's so few pre-seed deals out there, I imagine the VCs are investing in, you know, 10 to 20% of deals that they see.
I've also heard that the funds were awash with money, but not enough good deals to invest in.
Sure. So if you were investing in 1 in 100, obviously you would prefer to be looking at 10 and investing in 3.
Well, I disagree with that. I think where the weight of money is absolutely at the large management buyout end. There's an awful lot of private equity money focused on that. I don't think there's enough money focused on the earlier stages. We certainly find in the early-ish stage and mid-market that there's plenty of deals for us to look at, and certainly even though we didn't actively invest in any early stage companies over the last sort of 9 or 12 months, I would say the quality of deal flow coming through in that sector is better in that 12 months than I've seen for quite some time. But I think part of that is because of the scarcity of money. It's only actually the good ones that survive long enough to get to the point where they can come and talk to you.
I'd like to talk about some of the things that bug you, because I'm sure there's a few people in this room who are probably thinking about raising money, and sooner or later they're going to have to approach someone. What I'd really like to know from each of you is it something that really frustrates you about Australian capital seekers?
Some of the things that really frustrate me is that, again, if people went to the trouble of, you know, understanding how the market worked, would understand what sort of normal legal terms an Australian or a US VC will be demanding, what frustrates me is that when we go forward with our terms, sometimes the lawyers on the other side go, this is completely unreasonable, and we've never seen such terms, and, you know, you're trying to rape the village. It's just the standard industry terms, and it's the type of protection that our underlying investors expect to get for their money.
Any others?
I'd say that the thing that frustrates me most is that there is inadequate market validation or evidence that the team presenting have really thought through what it is that they're doing, and the place of what it is they're doing in the marketplace, and by the marketplace, I mean the global marketplace. So very, very, very rarely do we come across a team that have really understood what's happening in the US, what's happening in Europe, what's happening with their particular idea that makes it a really global opportunity. So the focus is much more on the technology they've developed rather than, you know, how it fits into the marketplace, who's going to buy it, why they're going to buy it, who else is working in this area, how they're going to be successful.
I would say exactly the same thing, that the biggest gap is always in understanding who else is doing this. And so you often hear, I think everybody here will sort of understand this. You often hear, well, nobody else is doing this. And those are like fighting words. It's never true. There's always somebody doing it.
Our business is unique.
Yeah, so, but that's okay. We see a lot of our sort of, you know, value add in this particular of the marketplaces, so, you know, being very good at kind of doing the preliminary research to find out, you know, who's out there doing it. I think, you know, other than that, it's really just a lack of awareness of just the way the industry works. And I would say, I'm not too harsh about that, but I will always give people the tools they need to go out and educate themselves, because until they raise their own consciousness, we're never going to have a successful conversation. So I spend a lot of time educating people up front. So it's not like I get irritated about it, it's just I sort of see it as part of my job.
My favorite one is the entrepreneur that says, if we just can capture 1% of China, we'll be made.
Yeah.
I hear that about once, well, about a year ago, I used to hear about once a month, I think.
Well, then, I guess that would be the other thing is there's a, unless you've been an entrepreneur before and, you know, taken a company from low to go, you have to ask where would your model for building a company come from? Where would you accrue the empathy for the cost to sell, the time to sell, you know, what it is, and how long it will take you to, you know, create this product out of, you know, some results and so forth. So there's a real absence of empathy you find oftentimes because you know, people just haven't seen the movie before. But, you know, Mike was talking about when you are dealing with a team that's done it before, it happens so easily.
Mm. There was something that we were talking about a little bit earlier before we even started, but on occasion, or more than on occasion, venture capital is just completely inappropriate. Is that correct?
Yes.
What's a good example of that where someone may have knocked on your door had to say, go visit a bank?
Okay. I wanted to do my pet peeve first,
okay,
if that's okay.
Oh,
which
sure,
is,
go ahead.
We only do life sciences. If people come to us and say, I've got a cure for cancer, and they won't tell us what the cure is. And, you know, we specialise in life sciences. Most people in our team either have a PhD in a relevant discipline or they've been a doctor for a number of years. All we do is look at life sciences. And it's really very tedious having to sit there, having people say, I'm sorry, I can't tell you anything about it because, you know, it's intellectual property and it's protected. So if you're going to a technology-savvy investor, you need to be able to explain the technology without giving away the absolute details of your patent, in a way that enables the investor to understand what it is that you're doing that's special. And so just saying, I can't tell you about it, leads to a really unsuccessful meeting, which is frustrating for everyone. That being said, I love people coming to pitch. I think, you know, it's a brave thing to come and pitch an opportunity, and I really enjoy people doing it. But it ends up in a very frustrating meeting if you don't come prepared to actually explain what you're doing in an effective way. That leads on to, you need to pick an investor to go and pitch to who is relevant to your opportunity. So if you are trying to raise money for a company that has a new missile system, don't come to us. We don't do that. So, you know, it's just going to be a waste of everybody's time.
So pick your company and then be prepared to tell them what it is that you can actually do.
That's right. And then who isn't suitable for venture capital? Well, if you're not a life science opportunity, you're not suitable for venture capital from our firm. But if you're a slow growth opportunity and you can raise debt from a bank, you probably should. You know that. So venture capital terms are quite tough, and they select people who have businesses that have the opportunity to grow really fast. And so if your business is going to grow really fast and you need fairly considerable amounts of capital, you're probably better suited to venture capital finance than if you're a very slow growth business and you've got receivables and so on. Excuse me, not receivables, you've got assets against which you can get debt. That's a better source of capital for you.
We lose the view that we're no longer blind at the front.
They're also not concentrating.
I think an important distinction is between VC and angel investing. And I've seen a great number of very interesting businesses that could achieve an enterprise value of about $20 million. They provide a handsome return for an angel type investor, but it's not the $50 to $100 million enterprise value that we really need to get. So you see a lot, and, you know, there are quite a few of those that come through.
Stuart hasn't had his chance to say what...
What irritates me.
We've been taking notes of many.
Yeah, well, look, I agree with everything that everyone said, which means I must be a fairly irritated guy, I suppose. But the one thing I would add, and it's certainly linked to the market validation and competitors, but also on the flip side, I think what I often see is not enough thought about what will have to change in the marketplace. And so who are the players and how will they have to change their approach for your technology to be adopted? I see a lot of name dropping when it comes to alliances. And I guess my personal view is that alliances are make or break. If you've got an ally that can make a difference and will make a difference because you're motivating them properly, then you've got a good chance of making it. If you've got an ally that won't, then you've got a very good chance of breaking it because it will soak up a lot of your time and it just won't deliver to you at the end of the day. And so really thinking out that part of the strategy is something that I'm very keen to see.
So what are the magic words when you're talking to someone and in a short period of time they say something and you go, now you're on the track, that's what I want to hear?
Well, I would say certainly if they could say we've got a credible customer.
A customer
working with you, that's a big help. If they've got somebody, doesn't have to be involved in the business, but who is a credible industry reference that can actually at some level validate the opportunity or possibly the technology approach that's been taken, that helps. If that's sort of lined up on a plate up front, that's pretty powerful. And then obviously there's the human factor, right? At the end of the day, I think we would all say this is about people, and you know, there has to be some connection between the venture capitalist and the team or some member of the team. So you've got to create that spark.
I've heard it described before as a wedding. In fact, it was who was it? It was the Rogers. Yes, the Rogers that described it as a wedding.
My parents.
Yeah, your parents. Roger and Roger.
I think if you can come in and say that I'm solving a very well-defined problem, and that problem is both urgent and important. And then if you can, in the next breath, say, and this is the source of my unfair competitive advantage or blocking intellectual property position, you are 80% there. If you can just cover off on those two things, then we'll get into, is it big enough, and you know, the management team issues, and blah, blah, blah. And if you can hit those two, that's, in my book, you're 80% there.
Yeah, like, rather than finding a problem for your product, finding a product for the problem.
We see many platform technologies, and I wouldn't want people to opt out of coming to see us because they've got a platform and they don't know what to do with it, because that's part of our value add too. But boy, if you can walk in and articulate those two points, then I'm a very happy chap.
Michael and Stuart, what's an example, a concrete example where someone's walked in the door and you've gone, these guys, we want it back?
Oh, but basically people who could articulate, you know, in the very first couple of sentences that they've done it before, and they understand the market and they've thought through all the issues and, you know, they see the opportunity and know how to get there. So quickly you understand that this is a presentation that you need to listen to.
I think that's right. Someone that can tell their story succinctly and very compellingly is critical, because if they can't get that story across to me, they probably can't get it across to their customers, and then that's where the businesses are really going to struggle.
Any concrete company examples? I know that someone here is involved in SIG.
We were involved in SIG. We exited that last year, shortly after the listing. But SIG is a good example of all of those things. I guess, you know, we look at, firstly, is the opportunity there? Secondly, are these guys the right guys? Have they got the right technology to take the opportunity? And then, sort of thirdly, is that going to be big enough for us to actually make our returns? And they told that story very well and delivered on that story very well. So the opportunity clearly was big enough because the print companies were making enough money out of recruitment advertisements, and that was the market they were going after. So it was easy to convince us. It was compelling. Whether they were the right people or not, they proved to be the right people. It was one of those things where the potential was chicken and egg. You know, the advertisers will come if the job seekers are there, and the job seekers will come if the advertisers are there, but someone had to get to critical mass first. SIG did it. I mean, they made us nervous along the way. In 2001, they were losing $1 million a month. And we got to the point towards the end of that year where we had $3 million left in the bank. So we had 3 months to turn it around. We had a very specific plan to do that if we hadn't turned it by February. And we broke even for the first time in February. And they never looked back. And, you know, in the year that we sold, they made something like $28 million profit, not just revenue. So they really had the scale there. And clearly, in hindsight, they were the right people to achieve it, but a lot of it was, you know, investing heavily in getting that critical mass.
5 minutes before we get some people to jump up and talk about their companies, but on the point of exit, how important is it that someone, when they come to see you, has a plan for an exit?
Oh, and that's
great.
They don't have to have a plan of how they're going to exit. They have to accept that an exit is part of what the investors are doing. So again, understanding where we're coming from, which is we take money from superannuation funds, we invest it in companies, and at the end of 10 years of a fund's life, we have to return all of the capital. We're long-term investors, but we're not 15-year indefinite investors. We have to give the money back. So everybody has to agree from the beginning of the investor relationship that the investors are going to get out, and if they don't accept that emotionally, then we shouldn't go into an investment relationship with you. And a lot of venture capital term sheet terms are about that very point. They are putting mechanisms in place that orient us all towards achieving an exit for the investors. The rest of the company doesn't necessarily need to exit, right? So if the company goes public, you can stay running the company and owning the shares, but we have to have a mechanism to get an exit. If there's a trade sale, probably everybody's selling their shares, and those are the two major ways that we get out of companies. So you just need to understand that we have to do it. It's not because we're being mean, that's our job.
Sorry, Michael.
Yeah, what I was going to say is that you have to be able to talk about the logical buyer of your business. And therefore, you have to be able to articulate who's going to buy your business and why, and also for, you know, how much. And that actually gives us an understanding that you do understand the market, you do understand the market dynamics, and you can point to, you know, the type of companies that are the logical buyers.
I think in our case, we begin with the end in mind, and we select the areas that we will accept investments in based on where we know people are paying for companies. So consumer electronics, for example, you can get very strong multiples on exits. We were looking at a deal the other day, which was in the automotive sector. Automotive pays maybe 1x revenue best, right? It's a really difficult sector to make money. That's okay. If you can explain to us why you're gonna be the exception to the rule within automotive and do better than a 1x, we might buy into that. And in this case, we actually did. But that's how we think. We think invest into those industry verticals where high exit multiples are being paid, and don't stray from those verticals. So we do a lot in consumer electronics for that very reason.
Now I'm going to have to go for a quick wander to find out what the three forms we've got are. Oh no, they're right here. Okay. Ooh, the exciting bit. How are you going? Are you all okay? Are you not getting restless or wouldn't mind a drink or anything like that? We'll have question time in a minute too, so have a think about that. Okay. The top one here I have is a company called Flow Car Share. Would Monique Conheedy like to stand up? Now you've only got 2 minutes.
Oh, gee.
You're fine there, and you're the first one.
Okay, our business is Flow Car Share. The service is car sharing. It is an alternative to car ownership and an innovative form of car rental. How it works is cars dotted around the inner city, on the streets, in apartment blocks. We've developed technology, smart car technology, that enables people to make bookings for as short as an hour. Go down, swipe into the car, drive away, come back, only pay for what you use. You save a significant amount of money. Half of the Australian driving population drives less than 12,000 k's a year. They would save money using this service. The 20% that only drive 5,000 k's would save 50% of their costs in car ownership because of all the sunk costs of car ownership. This isn't a new concept. It's a proven concept in the US and Europe, and it's had significant investment by tens of millions by prominent investors in the US in the last 6 months. The value proposition to the customer is saves money. It's also much more convenient with increasing parking pressure, hassles of with insurance and maintenance, and there's also a part of our market that is interested because of the environmental benefits. The drivers are increased population density, increasing costs of petrol, parking and car ownership and the sub costs, and also demographic moves in terms of apartment living and that sort of activity. The market size, which I mentioned, 20% of Australian drivers would say 50% using our service. We aim to capture 1% of that market. We project revenues of $13 million in 5 years' time. Our record to date has been that we have developed the smart car technology. We've rolled out 12 cars. We have 300 members. We are at break-even revenues on our current cars. We're seeking investment of around $1 million to drive growth and capture the market in Australia and New Zealand. And our exit strategy is a trade sale to either the rental car industry, traditional rental industry, the automotive industry — Honda has invested in this type of business in the US to date — or the petrochemical industry. Shell has invested in this sort of business in Germany. So,
2 minutes up or one?
Yeah.
I should probably say we probably shouldn't talk about how much money people are seeking and that sort of stuff, because I think there's ASIC rules which prevent us from doing that. however, I'll ask you a question, yes. And then I'll ask the panelists to see a question. I've seen your product before,
yes.
And I've seen that using the Daimler Smart Cars.
That's right.
Could you just please give us an overview of the technology that you're using to give us a picture of the product or service itself?
Yeah, the technology is wireless technology. It has GPS and it uses the GPRS mobile phone network. So data from our server is sent to an onboard computer wirelessly. Data from that computer is sent back to our server.
And it's a swipe card mechanism, isn't it?
It's a smart card. Standard smart card type technology, and certainly there's opportunity for linking our technology into the new public transport system and expanding this part of Melbourne's integrated sustainable transport options, because it's the same sort of technology that the state government's using to develop their new public transport system.
How do you get money out of this? I understand why it's good for the consumer, but where does your business get money from, and how does that work?
Our business gets money from maximising the number of users using a car.
Sorry, how much do they pay you when they use a car?
Sorry. They pay an annual membership, $100. Then they pay as they go, $10 an hour approximately. We have plans like mobile phone plans to capture people on ongoing plans. So it's approximately $10 an hour. Insurance, pension, registration all included.
And so how much you get out of each car per year?
Per year, we get $1,500 per month. So I get my maths in a minute, but yeah.
Any other questions? Please come on. Yes.
Well, I think it's a great idea. Yes, it's already. I'm aware of it. It's already out there in the US. It's a company start up in Sydney. Is that you or?
No, there's another one in Sydney.
Yeah. Okay. So the key issue, I think, is exactly this, that there are, the technology is pretty, it's available, so the barrier to entry to do this is pretty small, so it's really a marketing challenge you've got. And then the second issue is, how big a business can it be in a marketplace like Australia? And so that's pretty fundamental, and just the metrics that you've described for your business strikes me as an angel deal. And I think that, I think it could be a very interesting investment for an angel investor, and I would encourage you to seek out business angels, because as you've heard tonight, you know, we're trying to get businesses that have got potential to be worth 50 million, 100 million and so on. And I think that's hard to envisage in this particular marketplace, given the dynamics for your business.
I agree. Very, very coherent story. Very well articulated, I might say, compared to what we've made times here. But I agree. I would look at it, and I would be a little bit uncomfortable about what the enterprise value of this could be in the relevant time frame that I'm concerned about, which is 5 to 7 years. And then I also have some serious questions around the exit. I haven't really kind of bought into who the logical owners of that business would be, but that is in no way saying that this isn't a very interesting and compelling business, particularly for an angel investor, and I think it could be a very attractive small, medium-sized enterprise to own and run.
Yeah, well, I've got a tip for you in terms of who the logical investor would be. There are a number of high net worth individuals who have made their money out of the car rental business here in Australia. They would be the logical partners.
Very interesting advice. Oh,
just to give my view on that, I thought that's very well articulated, and in particular on the opportunity side. The question is sort of why you versus anyone else taking the opportunity. I had a suspicion that if the opportunity is big enough, $1 million won't be enough to take it before somebody else does. And what's to stop the big companies coming in and just doing it after you've proven them the way of doing it? So they would be the questions that are looking at addressing.
Thank you, Monique. We give Monique a call. There's some wise words from Henry Ford, though, and he said, if I'd asked people what they wanted, they would have said a faster horse. Sometimes it takes one person to do something different. The next one here I have is actually a service provider, which is interesting, rather than a product or new technology developer. It's a company called Bailey Design, and Murray Cree has put his name on the form here. Would Murray like to stand up, or is he out having a drink? No, there he is.
You should be able to.
Okay.
Thank
you, Murray.
Our company's been around since 1971. It was established by Peter Bailey. It's run by his son, Mark, managing director. Peter's still in the business as a part-time associate consultant. We work in the field of product design. One of our challenges now, we're a $3 million turnover business, and we just charge out on an hourly rate roughly, and it's all locked up in proposals. What happens is we have a lot of companies coming to us and saying, we've got the dream, you make the dream happen, because we've got the investors behind us, we want to see the practical solutions and so on. Our challenge is that we end up seeing a lot of the things that we design out in the marketplace and thinking to ourselves, maybe we should have had a share of that, because we could have actually made a lot of money. The second thing is that being a family business in second generation, it's got a succession issue. And where do we go in terms of succession? Do we go to third generation? We know the success rate is less than 3%, or do we start to look at some sort of investment strategy? And the other thing that I probably shouldn't be talking about here really, because one of the areas we work in is looking at life sciences. People come along to us and say, we don't know how to apply this particular chemical or this particular mix or whatever. We've got the sort of stuff that needs to be in the human body. How are you going to get it on in a non-invasive manner? And some of our best work has been in putting non-invasive chemical entry into the human body. So our real challenge from an investment point of view as a service provider is saying, which way do we go? We can carry on making $3 million a year, and year after year after year, we'll charge out an hourly rate, we'll increase it along with the cost of living or whatever else, but we've actually got potential to do more. The other selling feature to an investor about us is that we have won ever so many national awards, and when the Global Design Awards opened up, we started to pick up Global Design Awards, and we know how to get those. So we've got this huge history of awards. We're probably going to get put into the Victorian Manufacturing Hall of Fame this year. But we're stuck in terms of where we go next.
I've got a question. Are you actually looking for capital, or you're looking for what you should be doing in your unique business environment?
Oh, I think we're looking for the question of capital is a very big issue, because our expansion up to a $50 million level design business is going to be about getting capital to come in and drive it up. We've got all the technical skills, we've got all the understanding, we've got all the knowledge in the background. It's how to take this business through to the right level. It's very hard to get advice in Australia.
Well, I think spent many years as an Australian consultant, we used to have the same, a strategy always gives birth to a decision to acquire a joint venture, invest, whatever. So I think everybody sensed the same thing when you were talking is, do you want money or do you want a management consultant? I think that there's a missing step here, which is get clear about what the business strategy is, and then if that constitutes an investable proposition, then come and talk about that investable proposition. But I think there's, you're not clear in your mind yet what your business strategy is my sense.
Well, I got two things that you might want money for, but you didn't articulate which of them. But one of the things you want money for is to buy the business from the family that's owned it for two generations. Okay, so that's kind of a buyer type of opportunity. Sure. And then the other thing you might want business for is so that you can forego getting paid for the design work that you do and get equity instead. And then you need to fund your operations. And they're kind of different things.
Sure.
So I think you need to crisp up which of those two you're after and probably separate them. So work out the ownership of the business first, and then once you've got the ownership of the business worked out, work out why there's a compelling opportunity to fund your business to enable you to take equity instead of cash for service, and therefore have a portfolio of ownership of the products that you're involved in designing, I think, which is...
Yeah, and I've got another issue that you need to think about, and that is how scalable your business is. You know, it's the individuals, it's the talent of your current staff that are able for you to develop those products. So, how do you get more staff, and how do you train them up, and how do you grow fast enough? So, the scalability would be a big issue.
Our issue in that regard would just be that we've turned over staff, and we still maintain the standard of quality, so we actually train them up and develop them well, but the issue is getting out and getting that extra market share, and I guess that's part of where we're looking for the investment growth to be able to build the client base. But I agree there's the issue of separating out the ownership. This is the whole equity question and where you go with your investment strategy.
I think that this might be a conversation for you to have with our panelists later on.
Sure.
In fact, I think the more logical discussion might be working out ways to introduce some of your clients to these people. And then lastly, we have a company called Davbo. Chris Dave is from Davco, and he specifically asked for the views of David from Allen & Blackridge. And his industry is his business is in IT telecommunications. Thank you.
Thanks. Hi, everybody. I specifically mentioned David from Allen & Blackridge, given this experience in early stage IT telco businesses, but let's see how the rest of the panel feels about this as well. Myself and my co-founder have worked on a business that is all about connecting computer applications with the mobile network. This is not necessarily a new idea either. This is something that we see growing very quickly in the UK and is now growing quickly in Australia as well. Applications, to make it more real for those people out there, are such as small businesses wanting to communicate with staff, with their customers. Many of you might have received SMS messages from your dentist, from your doctor, from your hairdresser reminding you to attend an appointment. This is something that is of significant value to small businesses. It reduces missed appointments, which are often missed revenue opportunities, and also improves communications with their customers. Similarly, many small businesses and even large businesses are using it to communicate with staff. So you're seeing it, Australia Post, Coca-Cola, and all a number of the bigger businesses that are using the similar technology. The reason we're focusing specifically on small businesses is that they don't have the capacity to develop this stuff internally as do many of the larger businesses. And we've now rolled out a trial with a vet and we're in partnership with a guy who actually sells newsletters to a number of vets. He's got a few hundred vets as customers of his who have been asking for something like this. So we've developed some software that integrates with one of the largest applications in the vet market for managing appointments and internal billing, and our bit of software is used to automatically send appointment reminders for pet owners to give pets drugs and similar applications. So what we're looking for is X million dollars to grow our business to a nice big number. We believe that there's an opportunity now to grow this business by refining it with our Australian customers, but develop a very scalable global model where we have small applications that interface with existing desktop software used by many small businesses worldwide to build a very profitable business.
Look, I think you're pretty smart to be targeting a service versus trying to sell software. I think the evidence is in that you know, if you're going to make money out of the space, it's a service. It's not, you know, trying to make a lot of money out of selling a piece of software. So that's quite smart. It's the right idea. It's where you should be. That's the good news. The bad news is there's a lot of other people there as well. So we need to have a conversation about in more detail about, you know, exactly your business model and how it works and how that is distinguished and differentiated from what is actually a very chaotic field. The other thing that our experience in these is, because we actually have done many of, you know, we've seen this movie many times before, you know, you really need to be careful about the cost to sell and the time to sell. A lot of people are out there making claims. It's very difficult for you know, your customer to sort through whose claims are real, and it tends to cause a bit of a logjam. I guess the last point is that I guess the thing that concerns me the most is the small medium enterprise sector. There are a lot of companies that have you know, crashed and burned trying to make a buck out of the small medium sized enterprise sector. I mean, I won't go into what it is about the SMEs that causes that to happen. There are a number of factors, but we really have to think very carefully about how you're not going to go the way of many that went before you. But I think, John, you know, we're not the only TVP investor in Australia on equal par with us. Not even Bob would be TVP, so John might have these comments.
I think you've articulated the issues very well. I think that clearly this is a very important area, connectivity and, you know, using next generation networks to enable business. And there are literally hundreds of businesses setting up to do this. So one of the things I'm not clear about is whether you think you have a unique sort of platform which enables you to go into multiple small sectors, or whether you just sort of customize, you know, an application based on your integration skills and so on a sort of almost a one-off basis. I think that, again, the challenge for you is to figure out how, you know, how you can demonstrate that you can really make this, you know, this a big company as opposed to a nice small business, because I think that there definitely is opportunity to make a good small business because you've got particular local expertise, local contacts. To David's point, you know, the SMB market's notoriously difficult to sell to, so you need some sort of channel strategy. You can't afford to be going out knocking on the door of every small business to do this. So you've definitely got to have some sort of partner strategy to actually get your technology out there. So those are some of the issues,
I think. Okay. But it sounds like you're a pretty driven guy, so it sounds like organic growth might be achievable. So today, Australia, tomorrow, the world, eh?
There you go.
Please thank David. Now, we actually have time for one short, quick one, and I just saw this and it sounded kind of cool, so I thought I'd invite the guy up. His name's Murray McDonald and his company's called Floorbotics. There's the fella. There he is. Is there any name? Oh, okay. Sorry, you're Murray McDonald?
I'm PGA.
You're what, sorry?
I'm PGA.
Okay, go for it. Cold feet, eh?
Yeah, Murray's actually up in Queensland, so unfortunately I have to be here.
Oh, please welcome Luke Hurley.
Okay, so, right. Wake up, guys. The robotic revolution is here. We're not talking science fiction. We're already beyond 2000. So what we have designed from the ground up is a robotic commercial vacuum cleaner. Put it on the ground, press the play button, and off it'll go in logical laps, recognizing obstacles and mapping the path as it goes. So the value proposition is anybody not involved in a company that's looking to cut its costs? Anyone? Put your hand up, I'll drop off my resume. So basically, we're looking to save companies their labour costs, which I think everybody's looking to do. And also, we're going to improve the cleaning capabilities. If you talk to anybody who's a cleaning supervisor or in hospital, environmental services manager or contract cleaner, they won't talk about problems in cleaning being mess. They'll talk about the people they want to do the job. So basically, we're cutting that out of the equation, which we think is going to be a big opportunity in the future. And our team, the second part of the good pitch, our CEO has experience working with Saab internationally. He's currently the CEO of Mitsubishi Australia. Our manufacturer is working in the automotive industry. He's got a plant down the road, I'm from Queensland, so not sure. It's that way somewhere. They've just purchased two facilities. They've just purchased two facilities in China, so we have a manufacturing partner. Our parent company has 15 years experience in the international commercial cleaning industry. I've got 5 years living in Japan, studying the robotic industry. So I've met Ivo and Ashimo and all those cool little guys. I've had a few beers with the guys who've invented them. So what else have we got? We've got some founding members of AMD. Does everyone know AMD? Like, they're Intel's competitor that nobody knows. But they're still pretty good too. So we're actually looking for, I guess, seed capital to produce the robots. And once they're in production, it's all going to pay for itself from there.
Great.
We hope.
We hope. You're going to get a car. I just have one initial question before I start. Do you have a prototype and can I have one?
That'll cost you $30,000. Just wait for the production.
Oh, wow, make James Dyson blush.
Yeah.
Any questions?
I think this is definitely a deal for Brigitte.
It's not a life science.
Crossover life science deal.
No, it's not.
Do Windows mind the kids? Are you targeting commercial or residential?
Yes, commercial.
Commercial.
Okay. And the navigation software that we've created can go into a range of products. So we can go into minesweepers, we can go into security robots, anything that can potentially go across the floor and needs to go from A to B, we can design software to get inside it.
Okay. Now, I track quite a few newsletters in the science space, and I think originally across a lot of the developments in robotics. I haven't heard, you haven't told me anything that would suggest to me that you have, you're doing something that no one else can do. But I'm sure you are. So what is that?
Well, there are companies that can, I think, develop similar products. But what we're offering is the matching of the technology with 15 years commercial cleaning industry experience. So they may develop something very good, but they're not going to be able to match us in getting it to market. Does that answer your question?
Would you entertain the notion that that the largest household appliance companies in the world would be working on very similar projects?
We've talked to them about it, but it's a very slow-moving industry. How long has the Malcolm Buffett been around for?
I've got a key question I think you need to answer. Are cleaners coming to our office and they vacuum, but they also empty the bins? Who empties the bins?
So you've just asked a very good question in a roundabout kind of way. Our initial customers will be buildings such as, Ernst & Young. So basically, if you had one person come in, took the chairs away, and as they were doing that, put the robot in that corner, press play, and it comes along here, and as the robot's cleaning, they take the chairs away. And once they're finished, it's not only been cleared, but cleaned. So there will be a human element, but just not as much.
Any further questions? Please thank Luke.
Now, I'm sure you all have some questions as well, too, for our panelists. We have 10 minutes left before the formal stuff ends. Would anyone like to ask any questions? We have one taker.
Just talking about entrepreneurs coming in to see you about getting investment. How do you feel about investment banks or investment brokers coming to see you rather than the entrepreneurs? You've said we see these deals every day. The entrepreneurs are probably very good at what they do. They're not that great at negotiating the price of the economy. Do you feel about it favorably, or do you frown upon the sort of brokers?
From my view, I'm very comfortable having investment bankers or brokers bring deals to us. I think the key question is whether they have fundamentally managed to educate the management team about the process, and whether through their insight into the business they've made the proposition a better proposition that will therefore get done more easily, or whether they've just tried to pull the wool over our eyes and we end up taking far longer to get to the point where we don't invest and that's in no one's interest. So if they're really able to add value, then we're very happy to see.
I think the later stage of our business, the private equity end, MBOs, LBOs and the like, that's the primary means by which deals get to investors. So that's very much an exception practice. My own experience in early stage venture capital is that the quality somehow drops off dramatically. So if you are going to go that path, then do homage to finding someone who's credentialed, qualified. It's difficult to do because the whole fee structure for them breaks down if they're really good at the early stage, and you're not talking about $50 million transactions and so forth. But I think all of us would say our doors are always open. You can't be sort of dogmatic about, no, we'll never talk to them and so forth. I've certainly seen some instances where people like that really harm an entrepreneur's chance.
I would add that we want to see the entrepreneur or the founding scientist, the inventor, as part of the process. So I would, so you almost were suggesting that they were busy doing what they were doing, so get the investment bank to do it or the advisor to do it instead. That doesn't work, right? So we need to see the entrepreneur or the founder, and part of what we need to see is their ability to sell the opportunity and describe the opportunity and answer questions about the opportunity. So we need to have that face-to-face interaction. Once you've said that, and I'm talking more in the early stage end of the market, having somebody by their side who actually understands the business side of things and can advise them, but not bad advice, good advice, can be quite constructive. But it's really hard to find people who can give good advice, and I would be hard placed to make a recommendation to a founder or an entrepreneur about somebody who I really think consistently does add value and would be a good advisor.
Question
here. My question's about the angel investor space in Australia. Wondering what you can tell us about that space, that category of investor in this country, and what they look for that might be different to what you guys look for.
Well, I'll probably go at that to start with. I mean, I think first of all, your typical angel investor will be an individual or a group of individuals perhaps who have been successful obviously in some business and will have decided they're going to put typically small, one or two, maybe three or four small chunks of work, of money, relatively small chunks of money to work in businesses that particularly interest them because of their background. So the first difference is that, you know, they're typically only investing, I don't know, $250,000, $500,000. They have to have a very strong sort of personal connection typically with the opportunity, either because it's in their industry and then their knowledge and they get excited, they want to get involved in it typically in some shape or form. Those would be, whereas, you know, somebody like ourselves, we're wanting to invest typically between $5 and $10 million over a period of time. That doesn't mean to say we wouldn't just invest $1 million up front, but we would typically, you know, have a bigger objective out of our investment.
I think it can be, you know, really good first money. I see it continue. At one end of the continuum, you have somebody just coming in with the money. They don't get involved in your business. They stay silent. They don't get in the way. Take that. That's always good to have. Not that often that you find it. The other end of the continuum, you have someone like what John is describing. I think of Dennis Henley and CathRx, who's a good example of an angel investor who transformed the company. He had a tremendous amount of value from a strategic company development point of view, but also his affiliation with that company as an angel investor validated that opportunity in just about everybody's eyes, which is what the most you can ask of anybody that warmed up or is an angel investor. So always go for that. What we seem to find most often is in the middle. They don't have the subject matter expertise. They can't really add value, but they stick their nose and want to add value, so it becomes very destructive. So, you know, work at the either end of the continuum, but stay away from the middle.
Right off the back. Been up here for an hour, 45 minutes, maybe more. Right off the back.
Just what way to do that? By the way, there are some angel networks as well, forums where you can, where they organize for you to go in and pitch to a group of, you know, individuals.
I would say that the pre-seed managers that David and GBS and Starfish each run one of do invest in what in the United States would only be done by angel investors. Do you think that's fair enough?
I
think that the Australian government has said there's not enough angel money around, so we're actually going to get professional venture managers to do that sort of angel investing. Don't disagree with anything else that's been said, but I don't think that you should sort of think about the pre-seed funds that have been established as anything different from angel investors in terms of the amounts and the stage at which they'll make investments.
Hey,
I've got a question about the value of the passion of the company founder or investor, inventor in. Sometimes they're the best people to develop a company commercially, sometimes they're not. David, when I spoke to you last year, I was intrigued by the concept. You said you had a bench of all-star CEOs that you rotated in and out of companies. And I was wondering that sometimes they're an obvious choice and sometimes they're not, but when you're in doubt, do you err on the side of keeping the founder, or do you bring in the CEO, or does it make you reluctant to invest in that company?
I operate in the space that's quite unusual, and many times I'm starting with a great, a very promising or compelling technology, and there's nobody. And the bench I spoke about is actually a very small bench, but it's a bench nonetheless. Yeah, four people. Because those people are extremely rare. People can actually take something off a lab bench and actually start to build a company around it. That's quite a rare and specialized activity, and then attract in a senior management team over time. So it's not as neat as that. It's not, I'm often in a situation where I'm trying to, cajole somebody to come in to love this thing. So I don't have to really kind of move anybody aside. It's a problem, I guess, I'd like to have. So there really, isn't very often, again, it's an anomaly, what I'm doing is there's no aspiration on the part of the founder or the technologist to be anything other than the technologist or to, continue their career at the university and go some kind of back to the company and so forth. So I'm always out. I look at people as much as I look at deals. That answers your question.
The passion point is a very important point, actually, and it goes both ways. I can think of one of our portfolio companies where, in that really tough sort of 2001-2002 period for IT companies, we had to make some tough calls, and one of them we backed. Realistically, it was the passion of the CEO that got us across the line. But we decided we would give him enough more funds to kind of prove himself or not, because he had the passion and the energy to really make it work, and we bought into the new strategy that we've been trying. And the company survived, it's doing okay, it's making profits. Now the passion might be a problem, because it's probably maybe blinkering some of the opportunities that are there. And so it's sort of, at certain times it's absolutely critical to the business's survival, but you need to make sure that it doesn't get in the way of good sound business decisions.
Does anyone have any burning questions before we wrap up? Last question.
Yes, I was interested in finding out from the four pitches that we've heard, within the realms of this forum, from the panel, what their constructive views were on how pitches came across to you, and rather than from a technical business perspective, just from a purely communications perspective, what insights would you offer to the people that pitch?
I thought everybody did a really good job within a short period of time in front of a tremendous audience in what is, a lot of people will not pitch to in this forum. I think it's a really brave thing to do, and I think everybody who did it was articulate, pretty much to the point, got the information across. So in terms of critiquing the communication rather than the content of the ideas, I think everybody did a really good job.
I think it's a great question that you asked, because it gives an opportunity to talk about something with people I don't think really appreciate. Our door is always open, we'll talk to anybody. Really, it's expected of us, but you have to be really aware of how judgmental you're being in doing this job. And I'd like to say that, over time, as we mature in doing the job that we do, we start to become much more aware of how judgmental we are, and realize, and then the first encounters, I'm not much fazed by things being upside down and inside out and so forth. I'm just trying to get it behind it, really understand what the hell it is that you're the essence, the raison d'etre of what it is that you're proposing. And I don't expect you to come in with a pretty business plan. In fact, I don't want one. I just want a one-page summary that tells me that you're qualified to come in and have a conversation about this. We'll have a conversation. But, if a person dresses funny or if they don't articulate themselves well, if the people here pay too much homage to those factors, then I don't think that these people would be as successful as they have been. So it's really important to be very aware of how judgmental you are.
Thank you. we've got a very determined hand sticking up around at the back here. Can just touch the ceiling.
I don't need the microphone. I just want to speak on behalf of everyone here. It's really hard to get to people like you. And whether that's our insecurities, you have to go to the meeting, or
thank you very much. What a great
Ida doesn't return my phone calls either.
I did have one last question, and it's relevant. It's a great segue from what you just said there. How do people get in touch with you? What do you want to see? A one pager, an email, a phone call? What do you want?
All of the above.
All of the above.
I think if you can find somebody who knows the VC that you're trying to, I mean, first of all, understand what you, who you really want to get to see. I mean, as people have said here, there's no point in going to see me if you're going to talk about a life science deal, right? Once you've figured that bit out, that's pretty basic. You've got to actually find somebody, ideally, who can get you a referral in and say, you should see these guys, they're good. Because at the end of the day, we're like everybody else in the room, we are time poor. So somehow you have to elevate yourself to the top of the pile. I mean, it's just basic business.
But you know, there's more money in the Australian market than there's ever been before. So we don't have as much per capita as there is in the United States, but there is more money for early stage, particularly for very early stage investment than there's ever been. You just need to, if you felt like you needed to come to this event in order to speak to one of us, then you've missed the point, because we're much more accessible than that. And we're looking for opportunities. We're all of us looking for opportunities to invest in. That's our business.
I don't think I've ever not returned a phone call. The way that I like to be approached is I have a one-page template. I'll have to pass it to anybody who needs it. That's all I ask. Is that's the best thing to give me. If we have a phone conversation, I'll just very quickly try to understand whether you're a candidate for my fund or not. If not, I'll say, well, you need to talk to Peter, talk to John, or whatever. I always give people referrals to who this deals for me is for this person. So I'll always do that. I think the people here do that. And again, yeah, I think one thing that people get wrong is they think they have to have all their ducks in order. You have to have a nice, pretty IIM. You've got to come in with an investment banker. It's completely not that way. It's just give me one page. Just let me try to figure out whether I should go deeper and deeper and deeper into having a conversation.
You're probably all as thirsty as I am, so I'll end on a positive note on the referral process. Please, VC panelists, meet my friends here. they'll all be giving you a call sometime in the future, I'm sure, or something will, I hope. Please thank our panelists. Drinks will be available in this area for a short while as well too. There's some brochures at the front regarding the Ernst & Young Entrepreneur of the Year program, and another thing, VC Connect, someone mentioned a little bit earlier, a flyer for VC Connect, which is a more fuller discussion on venture capital. I think it takes a day, run by a group called Slattery's IT. Slattery's IT Watch? Yeah. So please pick that up on the way out. I'd like to thank once again our sponsors, Ernst & Young, supporters Oz Industry and EO, and thank you all very much for coming. Thank you.